very much, Ratnagosha. I did demur when Ratnagosha asked me to do this talk. I am the most unlikely person to give a talk on Buddhism and current world problems, because I don't know anything about the world. I do know a bit about Buddhism, but I don't watch the news, for instance. I don't read newspapers. Don't know anything about it. Where did anything happen? Anyway, I can say what I think Buddhism has to offer. I never quite know what I'm going to say, but this time, surprisingly for me, I have some notes, which is unusual, which sometimes makes things worse, but we'll see how it goes. The first thing I think that Buddhism has to offer the modern world is a vision. In a way, that's the most important thing, is a vision. What the world needs, probably more than ever, is a transcendent vision, which is not a supernatural vision. It needs a vision. That vision needs to be fully human. It needs to be coming from the human, not imposed upon the human. So not a God figure, not a supernatural figure. It needs to have all of the purchase of a vision, the shine of a vision. So it needs to be transcendental, but not supernatural. It needs to be truly human, and that it needs to go beyond race distinctions, gender distinctions. It needs to go beyond national boundaries. What the world particularly now needs is a vision that is transcendental but not supernatural, that can cross over boundaries in an increasingly divided world. We got a taxi here from the station, an Uber, come with Origin, and he's on Uber, and there's a Polish taxi driver, and we're asking him where he came from, and came from Warsaw, and you only have to talk to a taxi driver and you see how you don't need to read the paper, you can see how divided the world is. And it's divided very much at the moment between an increasingly extreme religious view, religious extremism, which is grown and grown, and weirdly, an increasingly dogmatic secular view. Weirdly, secularism has starting to sound like a religion. It started to preach a dogma of secularism. I think for Buddhism, the greater danger is secularism. So, for instance, I've taught at the London Buddhist Center a lot. I've taught mindfulness-based approaches to depression and addiction and so on. It's really, really good work, very important work. But if we're not careful, with that comes a kind of secular view of life. And I think it's secularism that Buddhists have to watch out for, not so much religion, if you see what I mean. Although, God is making a big comeback, isn't he? And this time it's personal. We need to particularly be aware of a sort of secular attitude coming into Buddhism. I've even heard people talk about secular Buddhism, which is really, really pretty insulting, really. You can never talk about secular Catholicism or and so on. So one of the ways in which the world is divided is between religious dogma and increasingly secular dogma. Remember that secularism is a belief system. I think that we're too big to be secular. For instance, the poet Seamus Heaney, he said one of the things about poetry is it's the only art form that can never be completely secularized. I was very struck by that. It's poems that you read at funerals and so on. You don't bring in a sculpture. You play music, but poems have never been completely secularized. They've always got a touch of religion. So I think that we're too big to be secular. If you've ever fallen in love, those of us who can remember that, in my case, it doesn't feel like a secular experience. Does it, really, when you remember? It doesn't feel secular, does it? Anyone who's dreamed, it doesn't feel a secular experience. Anyone who's really immersed themselves in poetry and art, it's not secular. I think we're too big to be secular. And we must be sort of careful of that. But that's one of the, you know, breakdowns, isn't it, between a dogmatic religion and a dogmatic secularism. So we need a vision that's transcendent, that goes beyond that dichotomy. I think one of the things I keep noticing is that there's something about Buddhism that keeps on losing the transcendent. There's, for those of you following the various forums in our order and movement at the moment, there's a lot of discussion going on, some of it very positive, some of it not so positive, some of it positively unhelpful. But one of the things you notice in it is that the vertical, the transcendent gets lost very quickly. You end up arguing like a political party, not like a religious movement. Increasingly, I actually want to use the language of religion rather than spiritual. I want to say I'm not spiritual, but I am religious. Because the word spiritual has got very flaky and soft and rather meaningless and nebulous. I prefer the seriousness of the word religious. I mean, only because it's of this particular moment. So we need a genuine vision that's transcendent but not supernatural. Isn't imposed on human beings from without, doesn't have the you know, that's a problem of God and so on. And that vision can't be democracy. One of the great issues of democracy is it's not really a vision. It doesn't have much motivating power. If you think it does, all you need to do is log onto Facebook. And you eat, the most positive thing about Facebook now is lots of pictures of cats. I saw a very good one of a panda eating an ice lolly. I do recommend it. It's really, really funny. He's just sitting there eating this ice lolly. Huge, great big, you know, panda. And then tried to bite it. Oh, it's too cold to bite. So it's a bit more, just like you did when you're a child, you know, when you try and bite the top off and it's too cold, so you lick it a bit more. That seems the best use of Facebook. Yeah, so democracy can't give you a vision. I was talking to Arjit on the way here and saying that, you know, post-Brexit, I would have thought we would have sorted that out. The assumption that asking everybody what they think will mean that you'll come up with the best possible answer, I would have thought we'd blown that particular assumption out of the water, but it's amazing how it survives. But there are real problems, aren't there, in democracy? It's not a vision. One of the striking things about militant Islam is it is a vision and it really motivates people. What we have to offer in our defence is croissants and flat whites, which I have no problem with. Yeah, so the first thing we need is a vision that's transcendent, not supernatural, but not secular. I think Buddhism is uniquely placed to offer that. And Buddhists need to guard and cherish that vision, especially the transcendent element of it. Otherwise, we'll end up with secular Buddhism. So our ordination, for instance, is not a secular ordination. So when I was ordained by my private preceptor, Sivadra, he wasn't saying, I'm kind of practicing mindfulness for stress reduction. I'm practicing metta for acceptance and commitment therapy and compassion-focused therapy. And then you're doing those things as well. All those things are valuable, but when you get ordained, you're ordained into something transcendent. There's an essential vertical dimension of it, which is very difficult to hold because usually that vertical dimension is held in religion, and that's become, you know, I think you know, theistic religions of all kinds is just a worn-out metaphor. It doesn't work anymore. It shouldn't work anymore. So the archetype, the exemplar of vision for the world, I would say, is the Buddha. The Buddha in his person is both transcendent and human, fully human. You know, when people met him after he was enlightened, he said, you know, people would say, are you a god? And he'd say, no. Are you an angel? And he'd say, no. Interestingly, they said, are you a human being? And he'd say, no. I mean, Bhante says that the Buddha is a whole new species unto himself, which I really like that definition of the Buddha, a whole new species unto himself. So to see the Buddha saying no to are you a human being denies secularism. It says that the whole of Buddhism is pointing to something more than being human. But it's very difficult to imagine that, because usually when we imagine something more than human, we either imagine something supernatural beyond the human, or we imagine something inhuman, effectively. So what we needed to imagine is something that goes beyond us, that is distinct from us, but not separate to us. That's the important thing, that it's distinct, but not separate. So yeah, the Buddha is the exemplar of that. He, in his person, embodies the meeting of time and timelessness, space and spacelessness. Human enlightenment is a great mystery. So the opposite to vision, I decided in my little talk today, I thought I'd have three things that I think the world needs. The first one being a vision. I wanted an exemplar of the vision, which is the Buddha. And I thought I'd try and dream of an opposite to that as well. The opposite to that is cynical rationalism. That's what I've decided to call it anyway. Cynical rationalism. By which I mean an irrational unwillingness to go beyond reason. An irrational unwillingness to go beyond reason. You do meet people who are wedded to reason in a way that's irrational, because reason is never supposed to take you to vision. What reason can do, a wonderful faculty that we've all got, it can clarify the options, it can clarify the terrain, it can never tell you how to act. It can just tell you, it can clarify things. It's a huge, very, very important clarifying function we've got. So it's not supposed to be a vision. But some people sort of irrationally cling to it. I was struck by Brian McGee's, many years ago, I read Confessions of a Philosopher, which is outside of the Dharma, was the most exciting book I've ever read, I think. He takes you through Kant and Schopenhauer and so on, and he's brilliant. McGee is brilliant at sort of taking you through complex ideas in a way that you can kind of hold. So it's like taking you up a ladder. And I remember being thrilled by it. You know, he starts by saying, "No, we believe this, but that can't be true, can it, because of this?" I remember once I was reading on the train, reading about Schopenhauer, thinking, "Oh, I believe this, I do believe that, but that can't be true because of that." You know? And I remember just for a moment that sort of crack in, "Oh, well, no, it can't be true then. That can't," you know, things like that I'm in direct relationship to you, that I believe myself, when I look at you, I believe myself to be in direct contact with you. That can't be true. You know, you're appearing upside down in two different pictures in my retina. I have to put that picture up the right way round. I do all of that in time, must be doing it all in that in time, but that time is never accessible to me. So my sense that I'm in direct contact with you, direct contact with objects, can't possibly be true. If you catch something like that at the right moment, you can feel your world for a moment grown out of itself, split for a minute. Trouble is, it sets very quickly again. But what struck me about McGee's book is that despite the fact he's very clear about the limits of the rational, and despite which he says, actually, I then explored all religions and I thought the only one worth looking at was Buddhism. He's particularly rude about Judaism for some reason. and he could see that Buddhism was the thing to do, as it were. He said he just could never make that movement. Interestingly, I didn't realise it, but in ancient Greece, religion was what you did if you were very good at philosophy. So if you were really good at philosophy, you then went on to applied philosophy, which is religion. You see what I mean? And he said he could never make that move. So the opposite of a vision is this irrational unwillingness to go beyond reason. It's often to do with a fear of emotion, particularly positive emotion. It's protective, it's defensive. It tries to defend you against the mess of being human, against our mythic life. And one of the dangers of a secular approach to mindfulness and so on, and it has got many, many strengths, I don't want to discredit it, is that it can get to this dealing with the human being as if it's a purely rational matter. In other words, what happens in cynical rationalism is that you start to treat reason like a religious tenet. I was thinking the other day that I think, to use religion in a different sense, that very much of what the human mind does is move towards making something that's supposed to be a method into a doctrine, and something into a doctrine into a religion. So Buddhism is primarily method. Bhante says there's only one doctrine, Pratītyasamutpāda, and then goes on to say even that's method. I think we human beings are doctrine creating. Because we're insecure in this world, because we don't know ourselves and we don't know the world, we have a great propensity to create doctrines, and those doctrines become religions. So Buddhism can become religious in that pejorative sense. Psychotherapy can become a religion. I've known people treat their past pain as a religious doctrine and not as something to work with and transcend. You know, I've seen that in recovery, for instance, that can become a religion. Insight can become a religion. Anything can become a religion in that pejorative sense, that it goes from being a method to transform yourself in accordance with a vision. Instead of doing that, it becomes a doctrine which you become attached to, and then it becomes a religion that you try and hit people over the head with. I think probably all human beings are always in that danger of moving from method, forgetting its method, move to doctrine, doctrine hardening into religion, and then using that religion, whether it's religion of your pain or the religion of whatever it is that you've grasped onto, using that religion to sort of beat people over the head with and say they need to do that. Yeah. Anyway, that was my first point, is that what the world needs is a vision. The exemplar of a vision is the Buddha, because he's born human being but goes beyond human. The word beyond, remember, is a metaphor. As soon as you say anything, you have to use metaphor. So beyond is a metaphor. It doesn't literally mean that. Above the all of those things, they're metaphors. You need what the Buddha taught is methods, so you get there, not doctrine, so you know what it means. Even going beyond the human is a metaphor. We can learn a lot from poetry from that, is that all our language is metaphoric, and a lot of the things we get tripped up on is that we mistake metaphor. Anyway, that was my first thing, my first what the world needs, current world needs, current problems. The second thing we need is a path. So first thing we need is a vision, a transcendent vision that goes beyond the secular and the supernatural, goes beyond God and no God. Then we need a practical path towards that vision. And it needs to be a path that can make sense of everything that we are. It can't be a path that leaves things out. So it can't be a pure, primarily rational path. It can't be primarily a path of experiences. It needs to be a path that can transform the whole of ourselves, reason, emotion, intuition, even our instincts. I've been wanting more and more to talk about this in terms of eros. Eros in the classical sense, not in the smutty sense. The metaphor of arousal. To make progress, there needs to be an arousal, as it were, of all of the human, their thinking faculty, their emotional faculty, their capacity to act. What you're looking for is arousal, really. I like that language because it's what the metaphor of arousal does. It tells you it's a complete experience, not primarily a heady experience. Yeah. I think one of the things that's happening with us is that we're spending so much time on the screen that I wonder whether we more and more mistake words for experience. I think because we've got such a strong capacity to cognition that we start to think that that actually is experience. And I wonder whether that's exacerbated by the net, that we live more and more in the cognitive word life, so that that becomes our experience. So when we say, what's your experience, what we're talking about really is our cognitions, because that's mostly where we're living. That's why the language of eros is so important, because you're wanting something arousing of the whole experience, physical, emotional, intellectual in the genuine sense, not in the debased sense, and so on. This path that we have needs to be coherent, needs to be a coherent path of growth. It needs to be a shared path, because human beings are share. You know, we're pack animals, we're group animals. So we can't possibly develop on our own. That's an oxymoron. It needs to be a shared path with a shared language and shared symbolic milestones. Again, there's lots of discussion at the moment in those of you who've been plugging into that, into our shared system of practice. If we don't have a shared system of practice with a shared language and shared symbolic milestones, we don't have a path. There isn't an individual path. That's a contradiction in terms. So we don't have a path. What the world really needs is a path of real change. When I first came to the London Buddhist Center when I was 25, that's what I needed, is a path of change. I didn't need lots of grand ideas. I needed friendship. I needed a path of human change. And that path starts as an ordinary human path, except ordinary human is too polite. Banting says in a poem, doesn't it, it's a hacked track through the undergrowth. It starts as something really very rough and ready. It did for me, probably did for you, and there's quite a bit of undergrowth on the way. Never quite gives up. It's a messy path, because human beings are messy. It's interesting, this word perfection I've been thinking about. We have this word perfection, but it doesn't actually point to anything. The problem with words is just because we've got one, we think they refer to something. So because you've got this word perfection, you think it refers to something, then you think, does it refer to that? Can we put that word on that? It's never existed. It's never existed, it never will exist. It's a fantasy word. It doesn't point to anything. You know, I can say mug and cup and water, and they help me with this. I can say perfection, and it doesn't help me with anything. It doesn't point to anything. It's a fantasy word. And it's a word created by imperfect human beings in an imperfect world, because they so much want something that's not like that. But deal with it, darlings. striking, though, isn't it, when you think about it? Just because you've got a word, the instinct is to think it actually refers to something, and it doesn't. I mean, the Buddha himself wasn't perfect. He taught a practice which meant that some people doing it committed suicide. That's pretty imperfect, isn't it, to teach that? This whole language of perfection is a complete red herring. There has never been such a thing, and there never will be such a thing. It's a fantasy word. But it starts, you know, in that deeply imperfect humanity, and it goes beyond that, highly metaphoric word. It becomes like the rainbow pass to Valhalla in Das Rheingold, the first. Is that the first one? Yes. Is that right? The first of Wagner's tetralogy. The gods cross over to Valhalla, which is the castle of the gods, on a rainbow bridge. And there's something about the path that becomes more and more like that. It becomes more and more difficult to discern and more magical, that path. It's a path of commitment.